Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
That, Prime Minister, concludes my presentation on what we know about the Grawks.
That's all very well, Tidyman, but what do they want?
Well, they don't seem to be hostile, they just...
Yes?
They just want to see the sights, Prime Minister.
The sights?
Nelson's Column, Big Ben, Starlight Express.
That's awful! Starlight Express, it is terribly vulgar. Take them to Katz.
Yes, Prime Minister.
And they seem to have access to a lot of gold.
An incredible amount.
Then let's be gracious hosts. But keep an eye on them, Tidyman. Where are they now?
Well, Prime Minister...
Don't mind us, just having a look around.
This is nice, Zork. Oh, taste this carpet.
Well, it's good to eat around here. We've heard good things about, what was that place called again, huh?
France.
That's right, France. Do you think they'd take plastoons?
My, what a lot of plastoons. I'm sure Mr. Tidyman will be delighted to show you around.
Borag Thung athletes, and welcome to the last episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast for 2020. I am your host, as always, Molchar, and what a year it's been. Almost 50 episodes of the lockdown tapes. Thank you for going on this journey with us as we have gone from interview to interview to panel. And it's been wonderful to know that these episodes have meant something, have helped people, even if it's just a distraction during some fairly dark times. Thank you to everybody who has listened, spread the word, and also given us feedback about the lockdown tapes. On this episode, a bit of a kind of a Rubin episode as we talk to Nat Tapley and Rufus Hound about the Future Shocks radio podcast, which is available to all subscribers of 2000 AD and the Judge Dredd magazine via the app. Now, these are audio adaptations of classic Future Shock stories. Stories by Alan Moore, Grant Morrison, Rob Williams, Al Ewing, brought to life by a celebrity cast, including Connie Huck and Janet Ellis, for listeners, watchers rather, of Blue Peter over the years, and comedians Rufus Hound, Al Murray, got people from Hollyoaks and EastEnders, and a great, great half-hour adaptations of a couple of Future Shocks per episode. And like I said, they're available for free for subscribers through the app. So if you log in to the app with the email address you use to control your subscription through the 2000 AD shop, then you will be able to listen for free. So it was great to be able to talk to Nat and to Rufus about the podcasts and how Nat brought this project to life, Rufus's involvement as one of the actors. Now, as always, technical difficulties meant that the chat with Rufus was relatively short, but short but sweet. Thank you to him and to Nat for chatting away. So we'll move on to that in a second. I hope you've all got your copies of the end of year prog Earthlitz. It's an absolute corker. I mean, Leonardo Manco's artwork on Slain is worth the price of entry alone. Never mind things like Strontium Dog, Durham Red, Judge Dredd, obviously, Visions of Deadwood. Just so much good stuff in there to keep you tidied over until we start again in the new year. So we're just going to go into the interview with Nat and with Rufus. But I'll do my goodbye now, I think, rather than wait until the end. So, like I said, thank you to everybody who's enjoyed the lockdown tapes this year. We're going to be back in the new year, continuing with the weekly schedule, I think, for the time being. Let's see how we get on. But it's going to be a difficult time of year. Lots of people unable to see friends and family as they normally would. So I hope everyone who's listened to this stays safe, keeps each other safe, and hopefully we shall see you in the new year for more from the Galaxy's Greatest Podcast. Splendid Verth Trig, Earthlets.
Self, let's see if this holds. Right, okay, look, I'm here now. Let's fucking do it, shall we?
Yay!
Yay!
Where exactly are you?
Where are you?
I'm at the Turbine Theatre, where we are currently performing Cinderella, a socially distanced ball.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Is that, when do you open?
I can... what can I do here? I can turn my camera around. There you go.
Oh, wow.
It's our little set, and we've got all Perspex screens so that people can bubble.
Amazing.
And, yeah, all of that. So that's what we're doing. It largely feels like a gesture of defiance just to be able to stand on a stage in front of people. So I've not done the maths exactly yet, but on the back of a fag packet, maths seem to imply that this is actually costing me money. But, but it means I get to stand on stage and get a room full of people to shout "fuck the Tories" repeatedly. So hey. I'm all in.
Oh, well, I mean, that seems like a perfect place to start, really. Welcome to the 2080 podcast, chaps.
Thank you.
Let's start off with some introductions. So Nat, do you want to explain who you are and what we're going to be talking about today?
Yes, I'm Nat Tapley. I'm a comedian, but I've also produced a series for Rebellion in 2008 called Future Shocks Radio, which is an adaptation of some of the classic Future Shocks you may remember from the past, done in wild new audio productions starring all of the best people of the day, including Rufus Hound.
Hello, Rufus. How are you?
And I'm Russell Howard.
Not without facial hair, you're not.
No, quite, yeah.
As the only non-mustachioed person here, I'm feeling quite new.
Yes. Yeah, it's not often the non-mustachioed, the smooth-faced brethren of the majority. Jesus, put a sentence together, Ham. The non-mustachioed brethren are the minority. But yes, it shows I'm in the right place.
Go on.
No, that was it. That's me done. I poorly spoke one sentence and immediately stood down.
I like the note of challenge. Go on. Yeah, but
the problem with the lag on things like Zoom is that you kind of assume someone's finished speaking and then you go to speak, and there's that moment. You carry on. I'm not the one who should be speaking all that much. But anyway, let's talk about what we're here to talk about, which is the Future Shocks. Adaptations classic Future Shocks. So, Nat, do you want to explain just a little bit about how this came to be?
It came to be because I love anthology shows, and I came to the good people at Rebellion saying, I think Future Shocks is an idea. So I love things like Twilight Zone, but even old school radio anthology shows like Lights Out and Quiet Please, and anything with a host who invites you in and then sits you down, tells you a horrible little story, then sends you on your way, delights me. It thrills me. Even when it was Roald Dahl doing it in Tales of the Unexpected, inviting us into his shed before, you know, saying something really horrible about the world and then expecting us to go on with our lives. I think that's an ideal format. And I've been longing to go on for ages. And I think Future Shocks had lots of associations for me from childhood. And I thought there were some great stories in there by amazing writers who we think of now as some of the classic writers of their generation. You've got Neil Gaiman, Grant Morrison, Peter Milligan, all writing things for it. And it occurred to me that those things should reach a new audience through the medium of people's ears. And so I decided to put them through people's ears. using sound.
Excellent. I mean, you've gathered together quite a cast for this one, including Rufus.
Including Rufus, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised there to hear Nat say some of those things, because I think one of the big things he instilled in us when he was putting the project together was how much he thought the art in 2000 AD was the thing that really let it down. And therefore, it needed to exist as an audio-only format so that it could outstrip the shoddy line work that hitherto cast it into artistic oblivion.
I think, what medium can we take to really strip this of any magic it might hold and to destroy it?
No, I think, you know, look, in all fairness, it was something that we had, you know, touched upon, but it was, I think it was more just a celebration of the writing. There's plenty to celebrate in 2000 AD, you know, not short the litany of incredible artists that have graced its pages. But, I'm not somebody who knows a vast amount about 2000 AD outside of its place in the kind of pantheon of British science fiction greatness, and largely because of the people who've been through it and the people whose work I've really enjoyed. I mean, I'm something of a Neil Gaiman buff, but yeah, Morrison as well. I'm pretty sure Alan Moore, you know, has once or twice put pen to paper for 2000 AD. So yeah, it was. It's kind of the understanding of 2008, where it sits in British sci-fi culture, and then really Nat Tapley being involved, who is somebody whose various incarnations I have greatly enjoyed, and has been a staple of my Twitter feed for a number of years, mouthing off about all sorts of nonsense enjoyably.
And now mouthing through people's actual ears.
Yeah.
That's a horrible image. Don't put that. Cut that. I'm not actually come around and tongue people's ears. That's...
Well, you say that, but I think we all know that the allegations have yet to be put fully to bed.
I have no more that I can legally say on that matter at this time.
Certainly not during a global pandemic.
I mean, you touched on something interesting there, which is obviously comics are a visual medium. So what is the value of stripping that away? I've seen people who've said, you know, I don't really understand why audio adaptations work, because Neil Gaiman had that audio version of
Sandman.
Good Omens?
Yeah. Sandman.
Sandman just came out. Yeah, that was, and I think that's an interesting one, because that is, Dirk Maggs did that, who did the, but what he also did in this sort of late 80s and early 90s was he did adaptations of Batman and Superman for Radio 4.
And Judge Dredd as well.
And Judge Dredd. Yeah, and I think he showed that these characters and the stories can be approached in a different way, you can reveal different things about them, they're strong enough, they stand up whatever medium you choose to put them in. And I don't think of it so much as stripping away everything that's loved about it as much as adding new lovable dimensions for people to discover and love for years to come. And also, you know, blind people can enjoy them now.
Yeah. Plus, and I'm trying to remember who it was who I first heard make this point. It was somebody very brilliant, but not brilliant enough to stick in my mind at this exact moment, clearly. But their point about different adaptations was that a new version of something existing doesn't mean that the old version is taken out back and burnt and removed forever from, you know, the world. Is there will be things in these adaptations that I think people will really, really enjoy that you just wouldn't be able to get from the comics. But that doesn't stop you from being able to then go and get hold of the comics and enjoy those pieces of art as well. And actually, my minor experience in all of these things has been when you provide new versions of old material, sometimes it encourages people to engage with the old material who would never have engaged with it before, and you can actually grow a fan base for the original thing that it wouldn't have been able to do had it just been left to moulder on a library shelf. So I there are a few things I have truly deeply loved. Preacher would be one of them. And, you know, the Amazon series that people really, really enjoyed is good for them. And I'm very glad they enjoyed it. But my God, it's not a shade on the original comics. But I then looked on eBay to see how much my complete run of original Preacher comics was worth. And it's about 19-fold what I paid for it. Yeah. So, you know, clearly there was a demand from people who had seen the Amazon series to get hold of the comic books. And had that been the case, you know, 2 years prior? No, it had not. So, new adaptations of old work just doesn't bother me. I think the producer on Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, the musical that I was in, wrote an article. I may have been for the...
Oops, you've gone muted. Have you, Rufus?
There's a long, long history of stories being adapted from... I mean, like, Passion Plays are an example of... That is an adaptation of a story from the Bible. My mind's gone blank because my friend's trying to phone me again now, which is very annoying, and I'm worried my earphones have cut out. But essentially... It has always been the case that stories don't exist in and of their own right. They have almost always been taken from something else. The creation story in the Bible comes from a bunch of different belief systems that existed before the Bible was written. A lot of what Shakespeare wrote were actually really stories that people already knew, but it was his posh version of them. Now people get very cross that things on stage are adaptations of things that were films or children's books even. You know, where are the original stories? But the reality is that culturally it has almost always been the case that all stories are adaptations of something that has gone before with a new spin, a new twist, or what have you. So, you know, we've been doing that since we were cavemen.
And I would hope that these send people back to the originals to a certain extent, because I think we've done such interesting things with some of them that I hope some of them people do listen up and go, oh, how did that work on the page? So I can't imagine any version apart from the one I've just heard. And it does give people an opportunity to experience them. I mean, I glibly made a joke about the visually impaired, but it gives people a chance to listen to the one when they don't have the book in front of them. It opens new media up. It's not taking anything away from the original. And if anything, I'm hoping it's going to draw people back, and then they can say, oh, look, that's the changes they made, and look at the differences, and it gives you more to love, not less. It's not taking anything away from you, just giving more to other people.
And what's the specific challenges that you faced in adapting comic books? Because it's not something that has been done an awful lot.
You get to know why fairly quickly when you look at them and see how many of them are dependent on visual reveals of, oh, look, they were actually very small and you thought they were normal size, or he was enormous, he was the size of the universe. So it was choosing ones where it wasn't a visual reveal. Because there's a twist at the end, it had to be a plot twist or a character twist. It couldn't be a, look, you were just seeing only one side of it, that character you never really saw in full. So that was the first challenge. The second challenge was some of them at four pages are not necessarily conceptually slight, but they are thin on plot. So we needed to work out where the story was and what the heart of the characters was and where we were going to find 15 minutes of fun with it. There were some moments where we found things that were very much of their time. I mean, in the world of the 1980s future shocks, the future is generally white men talking to each other in rooms. So we addressed that. I mean, quite often, it doesn't matter, the characters don't have to be. It was just that was the standard for what people were drawing. So we sort of made quite a conscious decision to make it more representative of the world as it is today.
And in terms of the ones that you did choose, you seem to have quite a nice mix. You know, you've got some Alan Moore in there, you've got Alan Hebden, Chris Lauder, Kev Gosnell, and even newer writers like Rob Williams and Al Ewing. Was that entirely based on the story itself, or did you want to get a nice spread of all these different?
Did want to get a nice spread of different writers, so but they were. It was all dependent on the story. There were some people who we would have loved to have in, but they just didn't have, they hadn't written any that would work in audio. So it all had to come down was, is there something you can listen to here? Is there an audio element? Is there something audible happening in this story? Is it an interior monologue isn't going to work for us? We need to have hover cars. We want to hear a hover car, don't we? Or Hitler. I mean, we had Hitler.
Well, I think one of the episodes is burping Hitler. Rufus, tell me how you came to be involved in this.
Listen, it's a very, very involved showbiz story that I couldn't possibly reveal, and certainly isn't the case that Nat just literally sent me an email and said, I'm doing some 2008 audio adaptations. And I went, cool, man, I'm in. yeah.
Can reveal the magic. Involves,
yeah, exactly. It involves trays of cocaine, CD yeah. members clubs, and furtive handshakes.
Oh, I wish that's the way it worked.
we're not in the 80s now, Tapley. yeah, look, it is that straightforward. You know, global pandemic, a lot of time on my hands. I mean, I would have done it had I been incredibly busy and working in Los Angeles for Steven Spielberg. But it just so happened that wasn't the case this year.
Well, that was going to be one of the questions I was going to ask was about the impact that COVID has had on this, because obviously you can't get people into sealed recording booths with each other. Bit of a risk.
Well, yes, because when we originally proposed it was the theory of how it would work was like any other radio recording. We'd get people into a studio and they could have fun. We could meet each other. We'd go for a big, long, rather boozy lunch. Then we'd come back in and we'd record some more and we'd go, that's fine, that's done. We'd all go home at the end of the day and that would be brilliant, but that couldn't happen because of a disease. So we had to record everything remotely, although it meant we spent longer in post-production making everything sound like everyone was in exactly the same place. And I, you know, challenge anyone to find any point where they can't tell that we were all in the studio together. But it was, yes, that it was, although in some ways it made it easier because people were more available, not to be, you know, to be thankful to the pandemic for anything, but it did mean that almost whoever I called and said, hello, would you have a morning we could do this in? They'd say yes. And we got brilliant people who otherwise would have been very difficult to get, wouldn't you, Rufus?
That's right. Very in demand. let's talk up my market value.
I'm quite enjoying the light show that you've got around you, Rufus, or lack of right now.
Yes, plunged into almost perfectly on cue. They're doing the lighting tests at the theatre I'm working at, and I'm sat in the auditorium. So, yes, in again, another visual medium for your listener to enjoy. Jean-Michel Jarre's over there. All right, Jean-Michel. Yeah, it's all kicking off here.
So tell us about the
gentlemen. I will happily. You'll please forgive me. I'm happy to reschedule and do more time. It may be that I have another two or three minutes. So if there's anything specific, I may have to dip out, and that's entirely my fault. I'm sorry for being so poorly organised. I tried to get to the theatre early, having been late yesterday, and in doing so, no one was here to let me in, which is why I then was in a pub next door that was too echoey, and then one place and another, and then I saw someone come into the theatre, so then I was able to get in. This has all been a massive shit show.
That's the subtitle for the whole project, actually. This is all.
So I may have to dip out.
Thank you, but
I mean, I'm sorry for not being a bit more focused than on it. At the moment, I just seem to be all over the place between ice dance training, because yes, that's the thing my life now contains.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
Do you have to catch people?
Not yet, but I have thrown a few.
I think, on the ice or just in general out of frustration?
Yeah, a bit of everything. I learnt my first jump today, and let me tell you, do I ever look graceful?
I think that's the wrong way around. They should teach you the being caught first, so you're aware of exactly what peril you're putting people in before they let you start throwing people.
Yes, well, I mean, spoken like somebody who fundamentally doesn't understand how ice dancing works.
because how dare you?
The incredibly petite, flexible woman that is my job to now hold upside down repeatedly doesn't strike me as being necessarily the first candidate for being able to hoy this fat bastard all over the gap. So. all I can tell you particularly about the episodes I was in is one of the great joys, I've done a little bit of voice acting now over the years, you know, worked for Studio Ghibli, that was obviously a major feather in my cap. I've done a few things with CBeebies and Disney, and you know, it's like, sometimes while you're doing them, you just churn through one to the next. And then when you actually stop and take stock, you think, oh, actually, that was rather good. this whole making it up as I go along seems to almost be working out. From a distance, it looks like I know what I'm doing. And so to get these scripts that were incredibly funny and to be asked to do a variety of big, kind of, you know, quite outlandish performances was just really a deep, deep joy. And as a voice actor, is exactly the kind of thing that you always hope is going to, you know, come into your inbox.
Can I just say that Rufus's performance in Drive, he said, is amazing. It's something you all want to listen to. It's really quite something.
I just remember recording that. And again, you know, you asked about the restrictions COVID had placed on us. Mm. I had a half-decent microphone that contained within it an SD card recorder, a solid-state recorder. But the meter on the side that judged volume, I couldn't see whilst it was pointing at me. So I had a Zoom call into the studio so that they could direct me whilst my phone was also on that Zoom call pointing at the side of the microphone. And it was the microphone that was then recording me so I could upload the audio from the microphone eventually on the laptop back to the studio. And so it was all really, yeah, you know, a kind of amazing to be able to utilize all these unbelievable technologies, but still at the same time cobbled together and ultimately Heath Robinson.
Mm. That was the most effective way we could have worked.
It actually sounded pretty good at the end.
Yeah.
So, you know, we ticked all of our qualitative boxes. Oh, that's perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, speaking of sound quality, here it comes.
But one of the great joys of it was that because of this weird cobbled together thing, the direction of Nat as to who these characters were and whatever, it just contained a lot of like, look, just go for one and then we'll tweak it as we go along. And getting into that character and just really letting rip and seeing Nat's eyes open double size was a moment I thought, oh, I've really overcooked this. And then got to the end of the line, he was like, yes, exactly that. was really pleasing because, you know, deep down, however professional or employed you are as an actor, deep, deep down underneath it all is the kernel of somebody who just wants to impress what is essentially a surrogate parent figure.
Amazing. I mean, it sounds like a perfectly smooth operation that had no glitches whatsoever and, you know, came in completely on time and, no headaches.
Yeah, it was fine.
Well, the irony was that once we actually got everything lined up, it was really pretty effortless, but it's just normally, you know, the reason that you go to a studio is there's somebody there who knows what wire plugs into what and all the kits there.
Yes.
Whereas what Nat was facing was basically making a series of phone calls in which he had to explain how to build a recording studio in someone's home out of various phones and cables and laptops and whatever else.
Yeah, and everyone
duvets,
had
pillows.
Yeah, everyone had different equipment available to them. So it was a case of, what have you got? What can we do with it? What will stop it sounding horrid? And do you have another person in the house who can help you with this in some way?
Yes, do you have a grown-up presence? Yes.
With the different future shocks that you've chosen, I guess coming back to the subject of how you adapt a comic book, a kind of special effects and dialogue will have to do, I presume, a lot of the heavy lifting.
Yes,
that the art was doing. Is that a complicated process? I don't know how these things.
Yes, it can be. I mean, we were very lucky working with great sound engineer Pete Dennis and a great sound designer Rick Blything, and we spent a lot of time with them, and they did probably a lot more work than they would have done usually, A, because we were all doing everything remotely, and B, because I really wanted to try and get unique worlds that you won't have heard before, but are distinct vistas. So it's not just the sound effects, it's the atmosphere in which each sound is set and the various panning. I mean, when we had sort of five-person scenes, we were working out physically where each person would have to be in the panning for each voice, which you wouldn't get because we weren't in a studio, so we didn't have the naturally people moving off mic and coming back to mic. So we spent a lot of time on that, and I think it really pays off because you can do a lot with where you move the sounds and what they do to make a world as big as someone's imagination can allow it. It's as big as you can imagine it. Is how big it is. It's not constricted by physical constraints. Constricted by constraints? I wrote the whole thing. Don't listen to it. It's all.
But it's been interesting over the last few years because, you know, with the rise of podcasts and audiobooks, I read a couple of articles about, you know, this is the end of radio. And yet radio production values seem to become more important than ever. Ever before, and I guess this is the consequence of that, that you can there is a huge hunger out there for adaptations of existing work.
Yes, I think so. I think if you can get exciting talent and exciting writers, and we did, we got a lot of new writers, a lot of exciting writers in and make something that's entertaining and unique and hasn't been heard before, and in the audio medium you can make things, you know, as good as the best people in the industry, without us necessarily having to hire a huge studio and needing incredibly good cameras. We can do anything as well as anyone can using ingenuity and a few microphones and good people, that's what appeals to me about audio as a medium. And it's why I think you will keep getting exciting work. I mean, even the BBC at the moment is doing some exciting stuff. They recently had their H.P. Lovecraft adaptation and The Sink by Natasha Hodgson, which is great. So there's interesting and exciting work coming out. I mean, Marvel have done a few adaptations, which they've done two Wolverines, and I think they've done Marvels. And I think the sound design on Marvels was spectacular. So there are really good things going on, and I think the more we can bring these to people, the more they'll realise that it's a good way of consuming things. It's something you can listen to on your commute before you go to bed. You don't even have to own a book. You don't have to,
Well, this is something that we're giving away to subscribers. So it's an exclusive item that people have to subscribe in order to get to our app.
Yeah.
What's your feelings about that in terms of, you know, these are going direct to the people who are the mega 2000 AD fans?
I have a slight amount of trepidation because I'm aware that fans of things tend to have opinions about things. But no, I welcome it. I think it'll be obvious that we've done things with care and with love and with respect and with a real nod to tradition. So when in Beware of Grok Sparing Gifts, the Prime Minister isn't mentioned by name, but was drawn as Margaret Thatcher. So we got Steve Nallon, who played Margaret Thatcher in Spitting Image in the 80s, to do it because that seemed like there couldn't be a more appropriate person. Again, we don't name the Prime Minister in it, but to hear that voice seemed like the most appropriate way of doing that panel justice. And it has been thought about panel by panel, and it has been thought about how we make it work both in an innovative and creative way, but also in a way that is in no way disrespectful to the source material.
And have you had a favourite moment, not necessarily from the finished product, but perhaps from the process itself?
I think, we had a number of things which I find the whole process delightful, but I particularly enjoy making some of the finest performers available to humanity do very, very silly things. So Rufus, who you've just heard, has to spend at least 10 minutes doing car noises and pretending to be a car. Tony Way, whose last job was jumping around with Tom Cruise in films, was doing, I made him do lots of Heil Hitlers in a very silly voice. You know, it's there is very little more joyful than, you know, getting to call up Janet Ellis and to ask her to do her best Blue Peter presenter voice to be a TV presenter from the future. It was joyful, and I hope that joy comes through. I think it does.
Well, there's a bit of a Blue Peter through line, because you've got Janet Ellis, who anyone of a certain age will remember, but you've also got Connie Huck.
We do have Connie Huck, yes. There were a lot of TV presenters that we called it. They were in the scripts, and I went, well, you know, mind of mind automatically went to Blue Peter presenters because they are the most iconic television presenters of all.
I like the fact that there's a kind of oblique connection through Connie back to Future Shocks, because Connie is married to Charlie Brooker, who yes. did Black Mirror, which is, you know, Future
yes,
Shocks.
Yes, which is essentially a...
yeah.
Yes. Yes, and we actually did briefly chat to Charlie during the production of this as he was looking for a USB-C cable to make the microphone work at Connie's house. So he has had an involvement with the project very briefly.
And I can kind of understand with people like Rufus, who do know 2000 AD, but I should imagine Janet Ellis hasn't really spent much time digging into the back progs.
No, I don't think she did. Now, interestingly, what I didn't give the performers were copies of the original comics to work from. I wanted them to work from the scripts and to do as much as they could with what they had there and to come without many preconceptions. So in some ways... I wouldn't say it was helpful, but in some ways, not them not having any preconceptions gives a real freshness to what they're not trying to reproduce an image they've seen. They're doing something that's really from them and new. So I didn't sit them down and give them a sort of crash course in 2000 AD before they did it. Afterwards, now I'm bombarding them with stuff. Look, this is you. This is the image you're in. Look at that. That's drawn by Jesus Redondo. That's you. That's your face.
So I'm interested in how the comedy works.
Yeah,
because you're dealing with an audience who, in all likelihood, are going to know these stories and will have laughed at them when they were published. Hopefully, they were funny. How do you kind of do something fresh with the joke, or is it just you kind of lean into the joke that as it exists?
I think what we did was where there was comedy there, we didn't take it out. So certainly some of the Alan Moore ones, the Grawks and Sunburn, have a lot of punny gags in. But we also wanted to surround that with a sort of comedic loam it could grow out of that made it make sense. So it's about having a slightly heightened reality. It isn't, I mean, because there are 8 episodes with 2 stories in each, there are 16 different stories, and there's a slightly different reality and world in all of them. I think what is a through line is it's always a slightly heightened reality. It's always a reality that's not quite where we are. It's never overly naturalistic. So that when you add that, and you add that, and you get essentially this comic performance. We've got Al Murray, we've got Ruth Bratt, we've got Lizzie Roper, we've got Jake Yap, we've got Darren Strange, we've got all these great comedic performers with huge track records, and Rufus, you know, Bemmy and Desiree Birch. What they bring to it naturally is a take that will chime comedically with those worlds. Hopefully.
And I guess the obvious thing, you know, if I was subscribing and listening to these, I think, well, A, why? And B, kind of what's next? And, you know, is this a dry run for something? Is this, something that you want to continue doing? Or,
I mean, I would love to continue doing it. I think there's so much in the 2000 AD's catalogue, or even Rebellion as a whole, and sort of the Treasury of British Comics side, which you could give a new life, you could give new audiences to, you could take a new take on, or maybe capture a new audience. I've got certain things I'd love to do. Like, I'm not sure I'm allowed to tell you what I'd love to do. The 13th floor, I want the 13th floor. But, although the anthology format would fit really nicely with Scream or with Misty, with Ghastly McNasty or Misty doing their bits, I would love there to be a sort of 2080 audio universe, or a, you know, Rebellion audio universe, where you could dip into the audio adventures of Nemesis the Warlock, or of, I mean, because there was the you know, the 90s Judge Dredds by Dirk Maggs, and I think there's real potential to do really exciting big work on huge canvases, which doesn't require, you know, multi-million dollar budgets and, you know, arranging. It's things people can make, essentially, as we've proven, under their duvets in their spare rooms, when they occasionally have to go out to tell their dogs or children off, and you can still make something that's as exciting as anything anyone can make.
It seems like a huge industry now, and certainly, you know, we've got the Future Shocks adaptations. Penguin Random House have done the audiobook adaptations that they're working on at the moment. So it just my consumption of audiobooks has quadrupled over the last year. It just seems to be something that a lot of people have realized, oh, actually we can do a lot with this.
Yes, I think podcasts have really helped. So I first did full cast audio comedies about 10 years ago. We did them as a podcast, and 10 years ago we did reasonably well. We were getting 10,000 downloads for every episode. We won some awards. We got well listened to in America, but there wasn't a business model that could support it. There weren't advertisers, there weren't sponsors really, so it was a case of everyone was doing it for free, and so it petered out after about 6 months to a year, because there was just, I couldn't keep asking people to come and spend lots of their time doing things for free. But now there are ways of making that. So many people are listening to audio dramas on such a huge scale, and just the general growth in podcasts has meant that there is a huge industry where there wasn't 10 years ago, and it's exciting to be in something where people seem to have, at the moment, an appetite for more and more great stories through their ears.
Alert! 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 Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.